Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Perry.
And I'm your host, David. Tonight we're talking about The Expanse, Season 5, and Book 5, Nemesis Games.
That is correct. We will be deviating slightly from talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine to talking about the book series that we have been diligently plowing our way through as we also enjoy Deep Space Nine, of course. Obviously, we're doing these things live, so I will apologize in advance for any technical difficulties that we may be having in the initial stages of getting things set up. I'm not really sure. Well, there's been a lot of storms in our area. It's been storming off and on pretty much all day, so I think that we're just kind of still going through that. So don't worry. Don't try to adjust your sets, as they used to say. I think it's on us, and hopefully this will all get cleared up so there's not any issues. All right, do apologize for that in advance, though, but stick with us. We will try to make this all work. All right, I promise.
Yeah.
So yeah, we are talking about the fifth book in the Expanse series. Again, it's Nemesis Games. Didn't just finish this one, but this is the book that we will be going over. And of course, doing a little bit of a comparison of the show itself that's on Amazon currently. You can go and watch the whole thing. You can go and watch up to the fifth season. They were being pretty diligent themselves and sticking with, you know, each season represented a book. There were some overlaps, of course, for the purpose of continuity and storytelling and so forth. But for the most part, they've done a pretty good job of keeping things spot on. And we just like to discuss the little bit of differences, cosmetic changes, basically, that they made here and there while we talk about it. With all that being said, I don't really know. Do you feel like we need to give any kind of like summation of this book at all? Or are we good with just kind of diving into it? Because there's a lot here, of course.
There is a lot. I guess we just give the brief synopsis of our four main characters are separate in this book. It's the first time we're inside the heads of Amos, Naomi,
Holden, Alex, and
Alex. That's who I meant. Yeah, Alex.
Those were our main four. Yeah.
Yeah. But normally they've been together, and, you know, Holden was the one we saw a lot of, you know, the Rocinante crew's perspective of, from his perspective, but on behalf of the whole group. Now we're getting into the head of all of them, which is great. There are a lot of great scenes in the book in particular that we wouldn't have gotten before, because we've never been in the heads of people like Naomi before. But the basic synopsis is the four of them go their separate ways in order to deal with personal issues that they had kind of been putting off for a while. Amos goes to Earth, Alex goes to Mars, and Naomi goes back to find her son, who she had with the now terrorist organizer and ringleader of the now Free Navy, Marco Inaros. Turns out her former boyfriend, father of her son, is now leading a massive group of belters to take revenge, especially on Earth, and they're taking Mars ships in particular from the Martians as they leave Mars to go explore the open ring gates. And a lot of stuff happens. The Rocinante nearly gets blown up. Holden has to get a new crew to go save Naomi. Naomi has to jump through space. All kinds of fun stuff, but we'll get into it. I'm sure.
Absolutely. So We've kind of teased this story, this book up a couple of times throughout other episodes of The Fire Caves, of course, you know, from when we just really began it all the way up through just different things that have come along during the reading that we were looking forward to or that we liked or whatever. Having to, you know, tamp ourselves back down to be like, save it for this. So there's going to be a lot of that. And one of the first things that I really wanted to talk about was the fact that starting this book, like before we got into it, I was actually not looking forward to this one because I had enjoyed the last one so much. And one of the things that I always said that I enjoyed a lot about this book series was the fact that we have a like an ensemble cast, ensemble crew, however you want to look at them, and they all get their kind of their own turn, their own representation in equal measure. And I like the fact that they were so good as a cohesive unit. And then in here in the fifth book, that's all torn apart because everybody's going their own way for one reason or another. You know, the David just said, you know, the ship was badly damaged. So they were in space dock basically getting repairs that were going to take months, as we were told. You know, none of the quick fixes like we see in Star Trek. Of course, but because of that, everybody was going to take time to do their own thing. You know, Amos finds out somebody that was close to him has died, so he's going to go all the way back to Earth, a trip which in and of itself was going to take several weeks. Alex has decided that he wants closure with his ex-wife, so he's going to go to Mars. Naomi has, you know, she basically gets summoned, and she departs, leaving, you know, Holden just kind of, you know, lost. He's missing everybody on the ship. He's the one man who doesn't really seem to have any kind of external connection that would take him anywhere too far, at least, from the Rocinante. So I didn't think that I was going to like that because, again, I like it when crews are together. And so then to see them apart, I wasn't really sure. But I have to admit, like, I really enjoyed this one. I think that this may even be my favorite book so far. Because of it. And one thing in particular, because there's one thing in particular I want to talk to you about, and it's the fact that, you know, we see the characters in their own right. You know, they're all by themselves doing their own thing. But the number of times we listen to them refer back to someone else, like, you know, Amos talking, you know, what would Holden do? What would Naomi do? And those two seem to be the ones that everyone else thinks about. You know, Naomi asks herself all the time, what would Holden do, or what would Amos do?
Right.
Amos and Alex, it's always what would Naomi or the other. You know, I don't think there was ever a time where Amos said, what would Alex do? You know, nor do I think there was really a time where Alex said, what would Amos do? But it was, but Naomi or Holden were the ones that came up the most that I noticed.
Right. And they thought of the other Alex and Amos more than Amos and Alex thought of each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, in this particular book, who would you say is your favorite character, and why is it Amos? So,
well, you already know he's my favorite, so that was a trick question right there, easy question. Well, yeah, Amos, I mean, especially on the show, I think it's, is it Wes Chatham who plays him in the show? Is that right?
Yes.
His portrayal of Amos is absolutely perfect. I love his character. He's so insightful. Both in the book and in the show, but Wes Chatham, when he plays him, just does him brilliantly. He knows stuff. He can see things about people. And we learn more about his background in this season. Mm-hmm. You know, he comes from Baltimore, from a bad background. We've known that he came from a bad background, but we really see it here. I'll refer to, I think it's season two when, or maybe it's season three, because that was when it was weird about which book is going on which season of the show. But the one where Prax was, they were finally helping him find his daughter. And Prax, at one point, they find his daughter, and he takes the scientists into a room and holds a gun to his head and is going to execute him, but he's shaking. He can't do it. And so Amos comes in, and he says, "You're not that guy." And then the scientist thinks that he's safe.
Yes.
Oh, thank goodness.
Because he talks him down. He's like, you're a good man. You're a father. You're a scientist. You're not a killer. You're not that guy. So he's basically giving Prax a pass to not shoot this very, very, very bad man standing in front of him. And so, the whole situation kind of de-escalates, and he allows Prax to pick up his daughter and walk out of the scene. And you're thinking, okay, it's over with, whatever. And then Amos turns
the
back
door
around.
Closes, and he's still there. I am that guy.
But I am that guy.
Great line.
Right. He says, but I am
line,
that guy.
Moment. Yeah. And so we've seen moments where Amos is shown, but again, as you just pointed out, this is a chance for him to be alone. Who is Amos without the other characters? It turns out he kind of resorts to violence when he needs to. It's what he knows. He helps Clarissa Mal, who had been part of Book 3, Season 3. She's the one who sabotaged things and tried to kill Holden while the Ring Gates scenario was going on. So we haven't seen her for one season. But she's now in prison, but she has all those augments. And she needs help. Like, she's someone who actually does want to change. She regrets her actions. She doesn't want to be known for what she did. And so Amos is the guy. He knows her. He calls her Peaches. He knows that deep down she's actually got a good heart. He comforts her in her lower moments. And when he's there, when things start to go, you know, hit the fan, he's there to help her get out. And in both the show and in the book, he's clear that he's going to be taking responsibility for her. And when other people are like, no, we can't let you take her. She's a prisoner. She has augments. She's committed murder.
So
no, he's covering for her. Yeah, go ahead.
So that whole section is great in the book, but it's also great in the show. But there's a part of it that we need to talk about that comes just a bit before. And that's, of course, when Amos, you know, makes his way back to Earth and he gets sidetracked by Christian Avasarala. And they have a great, great exchange. And I must say,
I shouldn't have missed this.
You shouldn't have. You should have known. You should have known. I was not going to let you skip Avasarala. I was not going to, you know. So what I really loved about the book and the show was how faithfully they did that particular exchange between the two of them. You know, now, I think anything with Christian is just great. And I just love the way that they present her as such an elegant person, you know, and then she opens her mouth and she says something horrible and you're just like, for some reason that just really works for me. I'm just like enthralled by her even more, you know? And so the whole scene with him, you know, calling her Chrissy, of course, and now she chastises him as he's not her favorite stripper. She's not his favorite stripper or whatever. And, you know, he's like, you could be both, you know, it's fantastic. Their interplay is fantastic. I don't know what that is.
As much as I love all the other characters on the show, if the two of them had a buddy cop comedy, I'd be all over it.
Yeah, if there was like if there was a whole
cop? Who's the bad cop between the two of them? Oh my goodness. Anyway,
I could just see like a whole, like, you know, maybe even three or four chapters of just those two having to like work together and solve something, whatever, and watching as she's like trying to order him around and thinking that she's got him under her control, and then he just does something and she's like, I didn't tell you anything. He's like, I don't work for you. Like, I can see it in my head, and it would work so well because every time that she thinks every time she thinks she's got her thumb on him, he does enough to show that he doesn't, which both frustrates and entices her because she's a person who definitely enjoys having people in her pocket, and when they aren't, or especially when they escape, it really gets to her. So I really enjoyed that. And like, she didn't understand why he was coming back. She didn't believe him when he told her part of the reason that he was back, because she couldn't believe that Amos Burton would be so sentimental, you know. But that was a great little bit of interplay between them. And then of course we get to Peaches in the prison, and I think the representation they did here on the show was great, was very accurate to what we see or we read from the book, of course. The only thing I think that wasn't translated well was like the starkness and the fact that they were so far underground, you know. Now, I mean, I get that because for television, you know, there are certain things they have to, you know, make allowances for and everything. But I particularly enjoyed the descriptions of the aftermath and how the world had so drastically changed basically overnight. The status of not just Baltimore, but the world itself, and how he was talking about like the smells of things everywhere. I enjoyed overall the descriptions in this book. They do a great job of helping you get into the world that they're working through.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I said it, you know, why is it Amos? Of course. Yeah, I do love the Amos parts. He's so non-committal about the violence. Like, it doesn't affect him to the degree, like, especially when he gets paired up with Peaches, this person who we know is intensely violent herself. Clarissa Mao is a very right. violent person. But now she's, you know, definitely trying to, like, seek this kind of redemption that she also feels like she's not worthy of. And then to watch her paired up with Amos, who doesn't think about it at all. It's just something that's necessary for him to do. So the two of them together, quite the interesting pairing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, especially true because, you know, Clarissa, if you remember from book three in particular, because you were in her head in book three, like, she killed people that she regretted even then. So she'd known that she was like tearing a part of herself out to try and do all these terrible things. And so seeing her redeemed is great. But putting her with Amos, who, like, the whole point about Amos's character is that he's been hurt. Like, that scene of him on the dock remembering what it was like to be told as a child, you know, I'm not the woman he goes back for, Laura, when he was a boy, she said to him, like, I'm not perfect. You and I will just have to pretend to be mother and son. But maybe if we pretend long enough, it'll, like, work out. It's a beautiful scene. Like, you can see that Amos is this character that's been torn up all this time. Mm-hmm. And he's only gotten through it by knowing how to execute violence at the right moments. And that's been helpful. But just like Clarissa is someone who's been traumatized by this violence and is trying to move away from it, Amos almost can't. Like, it's too much of who he is. Like, she can... Clarissa is the one that would be told, you're not that guy, and you can leave. But Amos is that guy. He will always be that guy mm-hmm. who can do the hard thing, which is why I love him so much. I think that's why you love him so much.
There is that, but I also love the fact that it's not something that he necessarily relishes, nor does he...
celebrate.
Yeah, he doesn't whine about it. Like, it's right. it's always you seem to get one of the two. Like, you get somebody who's exceptionally good at the things that a character like Amos does, and yet they're either internally they're just waylaid with this huge sense of guilt, and their conscience eats away at them, but it doesn't stop them from doing what they do, or right. they are really into it and they're just psychotic with it, and right. it's disturbing to really watch that kind of play out. I really like the fact that this is kind of presenting a third option here that I feel like I haven't really seen before. He doesn't look at it as one or the other. It's just, it's what is. It's what's right. necessary in the moment. Would he prefer a non-violent option? Sure, he would take that, but he would just as equally, you know, mix it up with someone if he has to. You know, there's right. nothing that would stop him, you know, and it's telling because he gets in the moments where, again, we hear him ask, you know, what would Holden do, or Holden wouldn't have done that in this situation, or Naomi would have said this, or what would, you know, Naomi do? Like, listening to him, you know, internalize that part and realize, like, before he could even get to a point of being like, oh, they would have done this, he's more like, but I'm not them, so here's what I got. And that's just kind of how he does it. And I really liked that. I like the scene where he is with his old comrade Eric, and he yes. is in Eric's office, and the whole time that Eric is talking, they're, you know, they're talking to each other, but Amos is also like sizing him up and sizing up the room and remembering the people who are outside, and he takes in the right. gun, and he's playing out multiple scenarios of what could happen. And even as he's doing it, he's like, well, Eric's also, you know, he's weak, but he's not stupid. So would he really give right. me this opportunity to get this gun and do this and do that? And that's what stops him from, you know, jumping forward and taking over in this moment. He right. is like, well, there's probably some things I don't know. So yeah. because there are things I don't know, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to talk a little bit longer until I get enough information to make a decision. But they arrived at a conclusion before that was necessary. And then he finds out, oh, yeah, like Eric tells him, yeah, if you'd made a play for the gun, there's poison darts or whatever in the ceiling. It would have sprayed you and you'd have died. Gun, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to read the short story about Amos from the Memories Legion.
Oh, book. No. I have not read any of those.
Okay.
I was saving that for later, but do I need to?
Well, so one of the short stories is about Eric and Amos when they're boys. Because it turns out Amos's real name is Timmy, as you might remember, I think, from the show. And from the book. But the short story is called The Churn, as you'll recognize. Amos calls, bad things when they happen. The churn comes and people's tribes shrink. They'll, when it's civilization allows people to pretend they're civilized, but when it comes down to it, they'll do what they have to survive. And The Churn is a great little short story because it tells you why that woman, Laura, was so important to him. I am going to tell you now. There is a very strange sex scene between Laura and Timmy. He is a teenager, and this woman who is a former prostitute and slash his surrogate mother, apparently the two of them have this relationship where they just need to get the rocks off, and that's how they, that's part of the relationship. I remember reading that and being like, what's happening right now? Okay. It's not presented as like romantic. It's like literally two people. They need to get their urges out, and they've just come to this understanding with each other. And, she's an older woman. He's a young teenager. I mean, literally, he's like 16 at best when these scenes are going on. But anyway, Eric was the one who helped Timmy take on the identity of the mob boss of the Baltimore area, whose name was Amos Burton. Amos Burton had a escape plan where he would go to space with a false identity. And when Amos, that we know, or Timmy as we know him, or Timmy, who is now Amos as we know him, he had to confront the former Amos about something, and that caused him to need to leave town. And so he's the one who took on the false identity of Amos Burton with Eric's help. So that's what the short story talks about. I left out a lot of details so you can still enjoy it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
yeah, for sure. Yeah, the other ones are fun, too. I'll quickly mention them. We have one about, it was called The Butcher of Anderson Station. That's the
that's about Fred Johnson.
Exactly. We have one called Drive, which was actually shown in the first season of the show. It's about the guy learning how to make the fuel content work more, when you have consistent gravity and then you flip the ship and the other way around. He's the guy who figured that out.
The father of the – it's called the Epstein Drive, and he is Epstein.
Exactly. And then the short story Gods of Risk is about Bobby being back on Mars, and she helps her nephew get away from her nephew is drug dealing. He makes drugs for some drug dealers, and she helps him escape that life in order to go to college. Last season, we saw that plot line repurposed. For she helps he was making the drugs for a guy, a former police officer. She tells that police officer who's the drug lord, let him go, I'll work for you, and they start stealing the technology. And at the end of last season, we saw a group of the Belters steal the stealth tech, including the son of Naomi and Anaros.
Philip.
So that was her first introduction at the end of last season.
So those are kind of the cosmetic changes that we're talking about. So like in the book, it does not mention the nephew selling the drugs, and that's the in that, Bobby uses to get the intel that she later has. Bobby's kind of more of a, work for hire, almost like a private eye to a certain degree, not nearly on the scale or level of Miller, of course. She's just kind of, bruising her way through intel right. gathering. And there's a lot I want to talk about from what you just said, even getting to Philip. But I will stop to talk about Bobby because, she ends up getting paired up with Alex here in the fifth book. And, Alex, I feel like, has always been a bit underdeveloped. We know he's the pilot. We know he's from Mars. We know that he's married. But, we don't really get a lot of internal agonizing from this guy until we get into this book.
Yes.
I, this is one of the things that I feel like is very similar to, A lot of other sci-fi, Star Trek in particular, when it comes to the lack of development for their hotshot pilots, right? We're supposed to believe that these people are, you know, they're so wonderful, they're so great at this one particular skill set. But beyond that, right, like, what else is there about them? What do we know? You know, and I feel like we get more about Alex than we ever got about, say, Sulu or Tom Paris from, you know, Star Trek, different franchises respectively, but still. But, you know, even then, even with what we get of Alex, I still feel like, why did it take so long? We had to wait till book 5 to get there. And even then, a lot of what we get, it's so truncated because we're using him really to fill in the gaps of the evolving mystery. You know, now because he's paired up with Bobby, we're also getting her, more of her perspective, because we don't have, like, there's no separation of a chapter that's called Bobby, you know, yeah, the way we have Amos or Holden or whatever. So in order to get the section of Bobby, we have to have Alex. And right, it's basically used as that kind of informational dump for us. And we see these things kind of matching up here and there. But I don't know if I really like that or not. I would appreciate more from the character. But I, again, all that to say, I liked it. I like Alex as a character.
It's an interesting thing they do from the book to the show. And this is another example of why I've always preferred the show's version of the story than the book's version. And again, not to say that I don't like the books. I just like the fact that it seems like the author has got a second chance to crack the story a bit. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the book, it's clearly stated that Alex and his ex-wife do not have any children. So they don't have any ties keeping them to each other. But in the show, they do have a son together.
Yeah, he's like 12, so, right? 12 or 13 years old. He's a younger
exactly
kid.
And so even when he comes back to see his ex-wife and she rebuffs him, he still has a relationship with his son. He says, hey, isn't it nice? You know, we're close enough now. We're not just sending messages to each other. We're actually talking. There's a scene where he's bonding with his son. And I like that. It really, as you just pointed out, gives him more character. But it also comes a bit late, especially when we, for those of us who know, I mean,
if you know, you know. Show, right. If you know, you know.
The guy who plays Alex, unfortunately, was, for some reason, let go from the show. Apparently, there were accusations that he had been
sexual misconduct
of some kind. I mean, neither of us researched it. I don't think either of us really want to get finer details there. Who cares? As much as the fact that it leads to the character dying at the end of this season. They let him, you know, do one high G burn for the final climactic scene, and he bites the bullet as a part of the scene. So, it's great that they did more to develop his character, and maybe the books, because he's still alive, will have more development. But you're totally right. Yeah, Alex, unfortunately, of our four main characters, has the least interesting backstory. And I guess they do some more with him in the show, because they have him try and, well, when he goes and meets his former commander of the ship he used to be on, in the show that commander rebuffs him, but in the book, the guy he goes to talk to, which I don't think is his commander, is all hi.
He's like a friend of a friend, and right, you know, their relationship is a little bit close, but it's not to the degree that he gets exactly what he wants, but right, it's enough that it leads him in a certain direction, which again brings in Draper for us. So
one thing I really like about the show too is that we get both Drummer, Ava Sarala, and more of Bobby, because as you just mentioned, those characters don't appear in the book, or at least if they do, it's only in connection with the other characters. And Drummer, we should probably bring up Drummer real quick. I mean, she has a whole plot line that the book never had. Do you want to?
No.
I could do it?
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So, first we should mention that the character Drummer is only first introduced in the books in this book.
Yes.
Book 5. She is like the second in command head of security for Fred. But in the show, we've had her since, I think, season 2. She was originally associated with the other guy.
Anderson Dawes.
That's it. She was originally associated with him, But she's come to work for Fred, she says, because I think Anderson's too extreme, and Fred's trying to kind of go that middle route. But last season, she had been trying to run the Behemoth, which is now the...
It's the Navoo. Now it's the Behemoth.
Now it's in the Medina Station. It's in the ring. But, you know, Anderson Dawes and her were like, you know, we're having trouble, you know, keeping all the politics out of this. You know, Fred Johnston is willing to play politics. She was done with it. So she is now with her own group of belters. They are basically scavengers that go find things to sell. And she finds Anderson Dawes's ship with her crew. And she has a quite emotional reaction to that because, you know, he had bought – or she had bought him a bottle of, I guess, whiskey or something to give to him so they could drink together when he had invited her to join him on his – basically his policing mission. But Marco Inaros last season captured him instead and spaced him. So
Drummer.
Drummer, I don't. My brain does that. Just things go away. When Drummer finally finds him, she has a most reaction. She drinks the bottle herself. Her other crew members realize that she's having an emotional reaction and try and comfort her. And it's a weird situation. I mean, it makes sense, I guess, in context. But basically, everyone on these ships, they live together and they also have a polyamorous relationship with each other. They're all intimate with each other. All at once, which is an interesting idea. I mean, I think that is believable. I think that might make sense. But that is that's the situation, which is interesting because we've never met any of these people before. So Drummer went from being the head of Medina Station / the Behemoth / the Navoo, whatever you want to call it, to now running a small scavenger
ship.
Operation.
Yeah.
With these people we've never met, and she's the leader of them, and they're all intimate with each other. You know, we talk about we're a family, which we'll get into why that's important later. But yeah, Drummer in the book is only kind of introduced, and she's kind of more of a minor character, but she's replaced in the show by Bull, which in the book, Bull was a point of view character in book 3, and he died in book 3, mm-hmm. And now we finally see him in season 5. And he basically takes the place the Drummer's character had in the books for book 5. And he becomes our new pilot, basically.
In the show, once they got rid of, yes. Once Alex dies in the show, Bull becomes our pilot. So,
yeah.
And that's an interesting way to bring that character into the show, considering, you know, we had already basically passed over him in the book. So it's like, it's weird to see him show up. And it almost is like, if the show is going to continue, does this mean he's going to die at some point? Because we know what happens to him from the book perspective. Now, obviously, this is a great time to say that the show ended after season 6. There has been a lot of talk. There's been little talk. There's been no talk. However you want to look at it, about them coming back and finishing the series. Now, in the book, yeah, the book series is 9 official books of the series. There is a 10th book, which is kind of that amalgam of short stories that David was talking about. But for the sake of the show, there would be 3 more seasons at least that need to be done in order to finish this out. Now, will the show come back for 3 more seasons? Will they just scrap all that and give us maybe a movie or two to get this all wrapped up and done? I don't know. I would love to see it as like a part 1, part 2 major movie, you know, give it that same kind of big push. I don't think that it would happen simply because, I don't know if enough people know about it to make it worth it for
I'm just remembering, I mean, you and I have talked about it before, but Firefly and the movie Serenity, the whole idea was Serenity, the movie, was the capstone to the show Firefly, which was aborted and after 1 season, fantastic season.
Which, you know, to talk about Firefly real quick, that's hilarious because when that movie came out, I didn't know anything about Firefly. And so we watched this movie and I watched it with friends of mine. And, like, again, I was in a room, a bunch of people. We didn't go to the movie theater or anything like that. We were just, like, on campus somewhere, and we watched it. And everybody, I mean, and literally everybody in the room after we watched it, they were like, this is fantastic. What is this? Is there going to be more? We knew nothing about it. And then to find out that it was based off of a TV show, this is one of my favorite stories to tell, my own little experience with Firefly real quick, which is basically, so like I said, we watched the movie, we loved the movie, and so then we went, me and a good friend of mine went to Walmart, and we're looking everywhere. Is there a part two? Is there more? Whatever it is, and just happened to find the DVD set of Firefly. And so we're looking around, and there's only one. And I was like, well, we can't, and we didn't ask anybody, of course, it was just the two of us. And I was like, well, it doesn't matter if we can't find any of the other seasons. We'll get this one. If we like it, we'll order the other seasons. Went back, gathered everybody up, and for a couple of weeks, we would just get everybody together and we would watch like an episode or two just together. And again, we all loved it. And when it was over, it was, okay, we have to find season two. And when we found out there was no season two, like a colossal letdown of like 50 strong people.
Oh, no. You know? My remembering of this story is you go to the Walmart guy and say, where's season two?
That's what I'm saying. We went, so we go back and it was... hey, where is season two? Is there a season two of this? And the guy, just the look of just pure like shock, then delight, then he got to just laugh at us. And it was me and my friend Rick, and we're pretty decent sized guys. So, you know, laughing in our face is not something that anybody would really do. But I just, it shocked him so much. And his laugh just seemed so joyous. And I mean, he laughed himself to the point where he couldn't breathe. And then he finally stopped and he was like, there's no season two. And then he explained the situation. And I mean, heartbroken. And then we had to go back and tell everybody else that there was no season two. People didn't believe us. They thought we were making it up. There was no way a show that good could only have one season. And then we're looking it up. We're on message boards and everything else. And I mean, it was shocking. Still shocking. And I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of Firefly fans and so forth who did their own research looking around and so forth. And
I read the characters' names, but who's the guy who he's the hot shot, you know, he's the one who's always gung-ho, he's
Jane,
the hothead. Jane. I'm just thinking, like, yeah, anyone who watched Firefly, you can see, like, how that character might have been an Amos inspiration. Like, Amos isn't the hothead like he is, but he's also the gun nerd, you know, the gun guy, the one, I need you to have a gun and take care of some business.
There's a great scene in Firefly where Jane tries to sell his favorite gun, named Vera, for a woman. It's stuff like that. Again, great. See, even right now, thinking about it, I'm like, I can't believe there's only been, and now it's been like, what, 20, 25 years since?
I'd say probably closer to 20, but not 25, but I don't know, I'm wrong.
You know, and Nathan Fillion is off doing every other thing now, and you get updates randomly from all the other stars and stuff on the show. I think most of them have all moved on to other shows and stuff. I know Summer Glau was doing that Sarah Connor show for a while. Alan Tudyk, he's got a show right now. And then
Resident Alien, I think.
Yes, Resident Alien. And then Gina Torres was on Suits for a while. So
she was the boss.
Yeah.
She was the head honcho.
So they all landed on their feet, let's just say. No one is hard up. They've all done quite well in their intervening 20, 25 years, whatever it is, since that show. But recently, Summer Glau was saying how she would like to revisit those characters again. Don't know if that's going to happen, but I just know that it's something that was said. But again, it's kind of like, to bring us all the way back, it's kind of like the Expanse series. Sheree Adashley.
If you like the Expanse, you'll like Firefly.
Yeah, you really will. You really will.
Yeah.
And Sheree Adashley, who plays Christian Avasarala, she has said many times that she's eager and willing to come back and continue the stories. And she even predicted at one point that they would do at least one movie. So they've all continued to do things. I know that Wes Chatham does a podcast that is about The Expanse, and you will frequently find a lot of the actors and actresses on the podcast. It's him and one of the writers.
Authors.
Yeah. They do it, and they give a great breakdown of the show and you know, different types of development styles, things like that. It's a great podcast to tune into. I don't know if they're still doing it, because I know they were doing it right up until the show was canceled, and so it's been a we're a couple of years now, right? What are we? Three? Is it 3 years since the last episode? Maybe four?
I guess we could check it real quick. I have it pulled up here. It ended in 2022.
Okay, Season six, two years.
Yeah, yeah.
I really don't understand why it got canceled. This is the next part we're going to talk about. The show was immensely popular. From what I could tell, it was doing quite well for Amazon. Mm-hmm. I really feel like Amazon pulled the plug because they were trying to put more money and marketing and stuff behind the Lord of the Rings series, because
that's my understanding. A lot of things had to make room for the Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power show, because it was the most expensive show ever made.
Yes.
Like, well, I mean, I don't think you guys got what you paid for, from what I've heard.
I've heard too. I never watched it. I heard that it was not that great. There was a lot of backlash about the development and the styling and inclusion of certain, you know, races as elves and whatever else. The nonsense things that I feel like don't need to be a part of any kind of show. But, I mean, since that show's been out, have you heard any other talks or breakdowns or anything of the Rings of Power?
All I know is they're making a season two, but I don't know anyone talking about it. No one's like, oh, here's what we're expecting from season two, or here's the fan community talking about it. Yeah.
Which I don't understand, because The Expanse, like, from day one, had major, major traction. I mean, it just seemed to really grab a lot of people's attention right away. And the way that they were filming, in particular, the space battles and the flybys and things like that, hadn't really been seen since Battlestar Galactica on Sci-Fi. And it was interesting to note that, because I know that a lot of the people who worked on Battlestar did end up coming to The Expanse, not necessarily as writers or whatever, but like as, you know, for the technical stuff and getting the science right and getting those particular, the battle scenes, the flybys down. And they're great scenes. They are really great scenes. You can go on YouTube right now and the infamous fight of the Anubis ships versus the Doniger, which is the season one main battle there. It's been broken down so many times. Just, you know, you can throw a dart and hit 10 videos, and each one is still... It still looks great. And then, of course, you can just go to Amazon and watch it. So there's that. I would highly recommend this show to anybody.
Yeah.
So
so good. But
To the book. Back to the book.
Yes.
I do want to talk about this Naomi and Philip.
Okay.
Yeah. So here we have this character who we have been getting to know through all the other books. We now come to season to book five, and she's gone from being the main love interest of James Holden to now she is the mother of this, what would you say, 15-year-old terrorist, you know?
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
And at the end of the book, she finally confesses and tells Holden about some of this. And Holden is just, he's so okay with it. Like, I mean, I read that as kind of, he's just so glad that she's alive and that she's back with him, that he's kind of giving her this collective pass for not telling him things. Now, I just don't know how I feel about that. I feel like she owed most of them a better, more of an explanation than what we're given.
Right. Well, I will. Okay, fair enough. I will say this. I do feel like, especially in the book, we do get the sense that Naomi is kind of putting up with Holden a little bit, especially at first. The book really goes into, like, he was always falling in love with the next girl. He would go from one girl to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. So Naomi, in the book, had a crush on Holden because he was the pretty boy, but had never expected anything from him. And now that she was, like, the only woman around, suddenly she's getting his attention.
That was expressed in the first book. I will agree with you there. Right. But now we're deeper into the story, and I feel like they are both very much in love with each other, you know?
Right. Well, and then, but the book, I think it's the book that really makes it home. I think that maybe the show time, I think it's the book that really points out, like, she felt like she was going into danger. Like, not telling Holden the situation with her son and Marcos, sure. But the reason she doesn't drag him along to go find her son is because she feels like she's going into danger. You know, Marco Inaros isn't going to let James Holden live. You know, this is his ex-girlfriend now with some other guy. This guy can outshine him. So Holden wasn't going to be in a safe position. But you're totally right that her holding back on it. I mean, I think in the show, she mentions that she, like, Fred has found my son and I'm going to go to him, and then, like, tells Holden, like, this is going to be dangerous and I need you to trust me. But in the book, I think it's like, I'm not telling you anything. I'll get back when I get back.
The book is very much a, she does not tell him anything. She tells him there's something that she's got to do. She does not want him to come, and that if he loves her, like he says that he does, and trusts her, then he will let her go and he will not follow her. And so he's pretty much at a point where it's like, I have no choice. I have to let you go. Right. And then she comes back and she, like, ignores him for, like, the first whatever. Now, granted, she was pretty messed up when they rescued her and got her back. But still, even afterwards, like, the delay of getting us from the rescue to her finally, you know, talking to him seemed longer to me than it should have been. Left me quite frustrated because I felt like she was taking advantage at that point of the fact that he was trying to be understanding, trying to be respectful. And this is a very major thing that has happened since they stopped, since she left. It wasn't like she just, you know, disappeared and then came back and that was kind of it. In the interim that she's been gone, Earth has been attacked. Bobby has been beat up 6 different ways to Sunday. You know, they've got prime ministers from Mars and Earth and everywhere else in communication, and she's just been wholly silent, and only for us to find out that, one, not only is it her ex-lover doing these things, but her son is also intensely involved, and so is she. The code they used to override all these things was the one she developed years ago. So it's like your whole family, like, you know, you talk about bad apples, you throw that whole tree away. Like, all y'all are awful, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, she asked at one point for clemency, basically, for Philip. Without saying Philip, she asks. And Ava Serrallo just shuts that down. It's like, no one's getting a pass on Earth. I'll give you this. But if they were in any way involved in this, the asteroids falling to Earth, no, not a bit. Yeah. So,
and if I remember correctly, Naomi's like, I acknowledge that that's fair.
Yeah, she does. Correctly. Yeah, she does say yeah. So she doesn't give up Philip in that moment, but it's just basically like, if and when they catch him, you just might as well not say anything because it's not going to happen. And you're just going to expose yourself further. So, and she does wrap it up with basically saying she kind of, in that moment of casting off from the, whatever that ship was, the Chetsumoka or whatever it was called, that she rid herself of her connection to Philip as well, which is different from what we see in the show. In the show, she's much more agonized over leaving him behind. And even to the point where in the show, if I remember correctly, when she does make that jump out of the airlock, isn't Philip on the other side of the door and watches her? Like, he was
in the show?
Yes, because he was like, it was almost like they made it seem like in the show, he was sort of kind of coming around to her way of thinking and wanted to know a little bit more about her. And as he was making his way to her, he gets to the airlock that she's sealed, and unfortunately that one guy dies, but he watches her as she's blown out of the airlock. But in the book, that's not what happens. He is elsewhere and unaware that she's done this thing.
They realize after she's done it what's happened, as opposed to the show where he witnesses it happen. Yeah, in the book too, they make a point of being like, oh, Naomi, don't kill yourself, don't kill yourself, don't kill yourself. The show didn't emphasize that as much.
No, they made a big deal. You're right. They made a big deal about how she had tried to commit suicide years before.
Yes.
And so that was another reason why everybody was so intensely focused on watching her and telling her that, because they did not want her to go through that again. And so,
I forget the guy's name who dies, because he's the former friend of hers.
I forget what his name was too. CN, I think is what his name.
Something like Sin. Yeah, Sin. There we go. Sin is a character that I like the character in the sense that, especially the show, I should be clear. The character in the show, the guy who plays Sin, is great. He feels remorse, because we find out that when Marco Inaros had, when Philip was born to Naomi, but she was breaking up with Marco, he stole Philip from her and kept her from finding their son, and then meanwhile went around to all their friends and said that Naomi is having trouble being a mom, she's having a mental breakdown, she can't be around Philip right now. What he was actually doing was trying to control Naomi, and so the reason she almost committed suicide in the past by almost walking out an airlock was because she couldn't find her son. And when she decided not to commit suicide all that years, those years ago, is because she had decided, she had concluded that she wasn't going to see Philip again, and she had to move on with her life. And that's actually what led her to joining the ice hauler from season one, etc. And so when we see her now, she is trying to reconnect with Philip, and the whole, you know, people are like, oh, you're going to commit suicide. But she has already decided on a personal level that's not what she's going to do. She's going to live her life. And so when she walks out the airlock, which is a great scene, even though it doesn't make any bit of sense.
No,
it was hard. It's not suicide. It's the biggest attempt to live, like, ever. She is ready to try and get to the Chetsumoka and do what she can to fight as hard as she can to live. Warn Holden and the others, don't come toward the ship. It's rigged to blow if you get too close. She intends to die, she's willing to die to defend the people she loves, but she's not committing suicide. And that's what's great about that scene too, is because Philip thinks that she is committing suicide. She gave up on me. She always gave up on me. And Marco uses that against her with Philip. Marco is a great villain.
He's a great manipulator. We're gonna talk about him. He is the one of the things that I love so much, and I actually hated about the show. I feel like the portrayal of Marco in the show was not great. He's such an over exaggerated kind of, it's almost like a caricature of the person that we get to know in the book. In the book, he has that almost, you know, righteous anger. And I think we've talked about this before when it comes to villains. One of the greatest things that you can do with a villain is make the villain make sense. Don't make them so crazy that they're instantly identifiable as a villain and makes you not want to like them or understand them or side with them. You make them personable. You make their argument compelling. You make the desire to be a part of their team kind of strong in yourself before they do that extra bit that turns you off. You know, Star Trek does this quite well with a couple of different villains, but as we are obviously talking about Deep Space Nine, I was comparing Marco to Gul Dukat, and they are spot on with their love of themselves and this belief in their own self-importance. Marco gives that to us in spades in this book.
100%. Yeah. Yeah, so one interesting thing from the book to the show, which I liked, but there is an issue I have with it.
Okay.
In the book, he's described as obviously a belter, but he's intentionally stopped talking in belter slang and has lost his accent in order to present himself as more acceptable for some reason. More mature, more professional.
I wouldn't say that he's lost it. I took that as he learned how to speak without it. Like when he wants to, it's an affectation he can put on whenever he wants. That's fair that's enough, how fair I enough. Took
probably
that.
Probably better accurate. Yeah. But in the show, he's like super belter. He's yeah. core. He talks in a hard accent. And I don't have the actor's name pulled up in front of me, but I do feel like his whenever he tries to talk, it always comes off as forced. I don't think he ever really mastered the slang.
Yeah, I think that's maybe why I didn't like the portrayal on the show so much, because everything he said on the when you're listening to him and you're watching him, it felt like he was doing this like he's really chewing it and spitting it out at you.
Yeah.
It did not have the same kind of fluid flow of a natural speech pattern. And I think they tried to work that in as he's just so angry and so passionate and so whatever that even his very words carry this sort of force. But I didn't like it. But when
the character they try to make it sound like the character is forcing out his language and passion, when it comes off as the actor is having to force this awkward dialogue.
The actor doesn't get the dialogue, right? The actor doesn't get
the accent's hard. And again, I want to say very clearly that I think if he had not had to do the accent, if he was just speaking in regular old American English, he would have been a little more convincing at times, because I think he does have charisma. He's a handsome-looking dude. He does play the manipulating aspects of the character well. But there were definitely moments where I'm like, homeboy's having to work.
Which, to that point of the accents, obviously the belter accent is quite hard. And before we totally depart, I just want to give a quick shout out to Kara G, who plays Kamina Drummer in the Expanse. She does it exceptionally well. In fact, if you go and listen to her, like just normal, speaking or whatever, a regular, there's nothing. There's no trace of it. Like, she does it so well. I thought that was her accent. I thought they worked her accent into the show. No, not at all. She's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Dominique Tipper, who plays Naomi, she very easily goes from the harder accent to the not. Like, she's very smooth with it. She's great. She can turn on the belter slang or not really, really, really well. I mean, I like the idea in the show that the character would lean into his belterness. Like, I think the book's attempt to be like, oh, no, he's trying to, like, somehow get away from it. That doesn't make sense. No, this guy is belter to the core. That's his whole point. So I like that change in the show.
Now,
we should quickly say, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to return to the Marco and Aris in the book here. We see his vanity play out a bit, like when Naomi goes to speak to him and he's working out in the gym and he's, showing off and he's doing all this extra stuff to be like, I bet your doughy earther boy doesn't, look this good or whatever. And he's clearly very upset that she is with James Holden. And it's less about the fact that he is just not a belter and for the cause or whatever, but that she chose him over Marco. Even though it's been like years since they've been together, she's probably had countless other boyfriends, whatever, and so is he probably in the interim. Right. But the fact that she is now with this particular Earther, as they call him, and he's quite famous. You know, he is the James Holden, and somehow she managed to elevate herself to this to this celebrity status with him. It just you can tell that it just eats him up. Yes,
yeah,
you can tell it just eats him up.
Yeah, it's true. But actually, while you mentioned that, the character who's not in the book, the woman who joins. The drummer's faction when they trade people, so the Marco Inaros, when he's been dropping rocks on Earth and he's been telling the rest of the belters, like, I'm leading this free Navy, I'm going to organize the belters into an actual cohesive force. He forces drummer's faction and others to join him by trading crew members. They have to give up one of theirs, and he puts his woman on his.
I always thought go ahead. I'm excited about that.
Well, it's just, her character is great because she's full of bile. She's just venomous, poisonous to the extreme. She hates Naomi. Naomi betrayed them. She's a traitor. Marco should space her immediately. They shouldn't even be messing around with her. And when she goes to Drummer's faction, she basically steps in and she's like, I'm the captain now, basically, because you're going to do what I tell you. I'll have to explain myself, which is why the scene where Drummer helps Holden and the Rocinante win that space battle is so great, because it looks like they're in a corner and they can't escape, and the Drummer and her crew, well, Drummer in particular, she doesn't even tell the others what she's doing, but she basically saves the day, which is a fun space battle. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, so like, as you were saying, Marco, he forces this kind of crew exchange. And it's, they talk about it as this, it's a blending of our families, because your crew is your family. As you indicated earlier, your crew is your family. They're a very tight-knit group of people. So I'm going to be responsible for part of your family. You're going to be responsible for part of my family. This is going to solidify our bond. In reality, what it's doing is it's putting people loyal to Marco on your ship and in controlling positions, while also allowing me to hold your people that you're particularly close to basically as hostages on my ship. Yeah, sure, they don't know they're hostages, but for all intents and purposes, they are hostages. If you do something that we don't like, not only will we take over your ship, because I've got people now on your ship to do that, but as part of your punishment, you will watch as I execute them. So that was that was definitely
a brutal scene.
Yeah.
When that happens.
Yes. So, and that's not something that we see in this book. Now, maybe that's where we're getting into the part where books 5 and 6 are going to blend together. So I'm looking forward to that. Have not gotten very far into book six yet, which, if you are curious, is Babylon's Ashes. I've got it right here. Ready to go. Nice and crisp. I was looking at it today, right? So, like, here's the sixth book. I've barely cracked it, so it's still looking pretty nice. Here's book 5. So, she's been pretty careworn. Yeah, it got around. So, I'm going to try my hardest to also just do a better job of taking care of the book, for sure. But I think it's a good sign that, you enjoy it when you can kind of beat up on them a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
We have to talk more about Marco because he's such a major part of this book. As I said, I compared him earlier on to Gold Dukat. Another character that he stands out for me as a good comparison would be Gaius Baltar from Battlestar Galactica. Only in the sense of he is this person who is quite convinced of his own brilliance.
Grandeur.
And his he's such a consummate professional. Like, even when we get the initial description of Marco, how he's got this fresh pressed uniform on of his own devising, and for the representation of the Free Navy, you talked about how he's changed his accent to speak in this way, and he gives a very kind of eloquent reason for why he's done this, to speak to the Earthers and to the Martians and so forth. And Baltar has done the same. If you watch the show, if you remember the show at all, Gaius Baltar is from a small farming village, and he grew up hearing this very kind of rural way of speaking, and he had that same kind of accent, but he longed to be from this other place of enlightenment, of philosophy, of art and culture, and he heard the way they spoke, and so he would practice for hours to change the way that he spoke, until eventually he did, and the accent that we hear of him is that very refined, polished accent that he's practiced for years, and that's who he is. He believes so much in his own abilities. It just shocks him whenever anybody doubts him or goes against him. And it's the same is true of Marco. Now, Marco is way more bloodthirsty than Gaius ever really was. But still, there are these marks about them that I noticed. And then, like I said to you about your villain, you need your villain to have a point that you can kind of agree with. And in that, he reminds me of Tom Zarek. Do you remember Tom Zarek from Battlestar?
Yeah, the one who was always, he was the former prisoner who also was kind of leading a political movement against
Laura Roslin, Madam President.
Yeah, Madam President. Yeah, and she almost at one point. No, was it versus Gaius Baltar that she decides to rig the election?
Yes, she attempts to rig the election. She gets found out. Baltar becomes president, which leads them down a terrible path of Cylon occupation, and then leads to her unlikely partnering with Zarek later on.
Yes, yeah, he was always a double-edged sword, you know. You work with him at your own risk type person. And that's exactly, you're right, because Marco Inaros, he works with the Martians for a time, but the Martians have their own play, as we find out
towards the end of the book, which is something that they started to allude to. They were talking about how, you know, Marco, for all of his, you know, grandstanding and everything else, he's not a brilliant tactician. He is not the military mastermind that he's trying to make everyone believe that he is. And so there's these inklings that we're getting that there must be someone else involved here. There must be someone else pulling strings. And then we get to the end and we see this new group of Martians who have gone rogue. Part of the Martian military that have gone rogue. They've got their own plans, their own. Basically, we are starting anew. We are leaving all of this stuff behind, and we are going to be the leaders at the forefront of all this stuff. And we've got a secret base, and we've got a secret military, and we're super secret. This, that, and the other thing. And you know, we even see him giving a dressing down to a junior officer who was wearing a bracelet that had belonged to her mother. And he was like, but that's a part of your past life. That's a part of your whatever. We're not that anymore. And makes her get rid of the bracelet. But then, you know, so we watched that. They actually did that in the show. We saw that play out on the show. But I believe the difference that we're seeing here is in the book, don't they all die?
In the show too. Remember they go through the ring gate to the planet system that they're going to go to, and the red wraith-like things just destroy all matter.
That's right. Okay. For some reason, I thought that they, like, I thought that there was like a fever dream someone had, but then they made it.
It happens in the book too. It's like the show just gave us a visualization of that scene from the book, because it's exactly the same. She has the bracelet. She's told, you know, we're in the military. We don't have time for personal effects. Yeah. You give it to me. And in the show, she takes it off and is dropping it into his hand when it happens. But I think in the book, he's in the process of dropping it in the recycler when it happens. But, it's a great scene because, of course, we know from previous, you know, books, previous seasons that the ring gate creators, they're gone.
They were destroyed
by something.
They were, something wiped them out. Something powerful enough to wipe out the ring builders is somewhere.
Whatever wiped them out is angry. We hear from Holden that every time he goes through a ring gate, he feels the presence of something. It's more and more angry every time they do it. And we got a brief glimpse of them even back during season four when, at the climax of season four, they're, Miller comes back and he's working that robot thing to try and shut down that glowing orb. It's not clear exactly what that involved, what that did, but we know that these alien entities that don't like the ring gate creators are not happy that the humans have started using that tech for themselves. So great scene.
So as much as this book was about humanity and Earth and Mars and what's going on here, we don't have a lot of proto-molecule stuff. We don't have a lot of alien stuff. We get more towards the end. Very little. We get this brief bit here at the end. I do love the proto-molecule stuff. I love the alien otherness. I want to see how that's going to play out. One thing that I thought was interesting, and this is kind of putting it all together, it's a bit of foreshadowing, basically, because as you said, you know, Holden has alluded to the fact that there is something out there. He hasn't totally vocalized it to everyone, but we know there is something out there, and it seems to be getting angrier, especially at the human presence. And what does book 5 give us? It gives us a reason for a more pronounced human presence going through the rings, because Earth has suffered this cataclysm, which is going to take it however long to recover from, as well
right.
as Mars as basically being abandoned, and all
right.
of the other, you know, Ganymede, Ceres, all of them are facing supply shortages, and so basically, it's
yeah.
giving us this window of the allure and the appeal of all of these unexplored, potentially uninhabited, potentially resource-rich systems are just out there for the taking, and
right.
unbeknownst to everyone, there is this thing out there that is growing in its hatred of humans coming through
yes.
it. So obviously,
yeah.
we're anticipating some kind of massive showdown. Will we get it in book six? I don't know. I'm very interested to get
yeah.
into that and find out. I want more Protomolecule stuff. This book wraps up our characters well. We don't need to do any more dwelling on our characters. We can now move forward. So I'm looking forward to that.
Right. Yeah. The other reason this is important, because all these worlds are now available to humanity, Ava Sarala in the books, at the end of last book, it went to Bobby, and she's like, this is going to be terrible. People are going to be leaving Mars, leaving Earth. We got to stop this mass exodus of people, because if they leave, they're going to create problems. And it's funny, because at the end of book four, she's like, I don't know if the Martian leader is smart enough to realize what's happening. Like, she calls him, you know, like he's a pretty face or something.
Yeah, she basically says he's an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason I bring that up is because one of the plot lines that is absent from the show that was in the book is the Prime Minister and his fleet of Martian ships are on the way to Luna to have a peace talk with Ava Sarala, but there's an attack.
Oh, yeah, one of the asteroids hit, and she dies. The new First Minister of Earth dies. That was, what was her name?
Right.
Gal,
but that's in the show. But real quickly, in the book, the fleet of ships that were coming to help defend the Prime Minister turn out to be bad ships, Marco Inaris' ships.
Yes.
And they attack, and so the Prime Minister is taken from a Doniger-style ship. This is like season one all over again, or book one all over again, and they put him on the Razorback with Alex and Bobby, and mm-hmm. they have them try and race him to Luna, and then that's where we get the whole Chetsumoka Naomi
yes.
plot. I do like the fact that they kind of cut that simply to make the show more streamlined, but
yeah.
I don't like that fact because in the book, or in the show, they're like, oh yeah, Marco Inaris blew up the Martian Senate, and it doesn't happen on screen. It's all off screen. It doesn't really bring any sort of oomph to that plot line. Whereas in the book, yeah, Earth is being, you know, asteroids are
mm-hmm.
dropping all over it. The Martian Senate or the Martian Prime Minister is under attack. It's a great coup d'etat that's being played. And then finally, the last season, or the last episode, shows the there's a bunch of little asteroids that were covered in the stealth tech. They just rip apart a bunch of ships around the ring gate, and it turns out that Marco Inaris had sent them, and the Martian fleet goes through right before that whole scene where the red wraith-like things tear up the ship. That commander of that ship, who used to be Alex's former commander, he says to Marco Inaris, like, hey, you have your ships, you have your system, you stay over there. And Marco's like, you stay, guys, stay over there. We're done. Like, we've worked together. We were never friends, but we're going to go our separate ways. And so we learn how he got those ships from the Martians. Alex and Bobby had figured it out, but we get an official confirmation, which is a fascinating idea. Like, basically the idea is we find that scientist who from season two had like his, you know, frontal lobe messed with. So
Cortazar.
That's right. Cortazar. He's telling the commander of the Martians, like, hey, I've turned on some protomolecule tech up in the sky. I can't wait for you to show up. And it's great. It's a great teaser for next season. And then the wraith like red things destroy the ship. But again, the
so which makes
Marco,
you wonder, it's like, how did they get there? How did the first group get there, considering the
yeah.
wraith kills everyone else? Like, did it like
well,
him?
Well, they were saying, I think, in both the book and the show that, like, there, well, actually, no, it was the book that really emphasized that the disappearances have been random. It's not been clear yet why or how I guess the show kind of emphasized it, actually, now that I think about it. But yeah, that there's something going on with the ring gates, and there are ships that have been disappearing, but there haven't been enough for people to really make too much of a fuss yet, because most of it's just been refugees going out, like, forget them, who cares, they blew up on the other side, they were going to die anyway, who cares. But that's when, you know, Holden, when he's confronted by the reporter, he starts thinking about it, and he's like, well, wait, where's the protomolecule sample? And Fred's like,
Get out of my business.
And then that's when the coup happens. You know, rocks start falling on Earth, and the coup on the station happens. And in the show, Fred dies.
That's true. Fred dies. And so I wondered about that, too. I wonder if it was because the actor who plays Fred Johnson, I think maybe he had another project he needed to be free to do. Not realizing that, you know, obviously the show didn't go past season 6. Whatever, but it doesn't necessarily matter, because I mean, we can continue on with the books that we're going to, obviously. But who knows, maybe he dies in season 6 or in book 6.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
haven't gotten to
the whole idea
yet.
Holden was he goes on the Rocinante with Holden and has Holden transport him to Luna, and on the way to Luna they hear the Chetsumoka, and Holden's like, I'm captain, I'm gonna save my girlfriend, screw your your summit. You know, I got things to do. Which is hilarious, Holden telling, you know, Fred's like, I knew this was going to happen. Like, I'm not even going to fight you.
I'm not even going to fight you. I already know what you're going to say, but because I just feel like I have to ask. I already know the answer, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Funny moment. Fred's a great character. I'm sad he's dead in the show. But then finally, we need to mention the Ava Sarala plotline in the show. We haven't done it yet. I'm surprised you haven't, like, insisted we talk about Ava Sarala.
Look, I tried to rate in my love, okay? Because I could talk about her anytime, all the time. Right. I love Christian so much. Yes. So,
funny story, by the way. I don't know if you're aware, but the new movie on Netflix called Damsel, which has the girl that played Eleven from Stranger Things. I haven't seen the show or the movie, that is, but I did see a review of it today. And apparently Shreya Dashalu is in it. She plays, I think, the dragon character. And the guy was trying to say her name. And he was, it's a funny review. He was intentionally being funny, but he was like stumbling over her name. Like, he just couldn't get it out.
He couldn't,
like,
say Sheree?
He couldn't say the whole thing. He would say Sheree Agdasha. And just be like, ah, screw it. I can't say her name. But as soon as he started saying her name, I was like, I know what the proper pronunciation is. Heard it from Barry a million times. Apparently the movie's not that great, so you don't have to see it if you don't want to see it. But if you want to see or hear her voice,
she does such great voice work. I'm not surprised at all. And he couldn't say Sheree Agdashlu. Okay, I bet he can say Daenerys Targaryen, like, with no issue whatsoever. You know, I bet he's got a couple of key phrases in Dothraki he can spit out like nobody's business. Like, that annoys me so much when people can pronounce made up fictitious alien names from sci-fi, supernatural, fantasy stuff, but can't say an actual legitimate person's name. Like, man, take 5 minutes and watch a clip of them giving an interview. Almost in every one of them, they say their name. Learn it. It's not hard. The most inobtrusive thing you can do as a sign of respect for a person is to learn how to say their freaking name. Just say it. Jesus.
Well, to be fair, again, the whole point of his, it was being comedic. He was like, I don't know how to say her
name. So, be comedic in other ways. That's one of the things that just annoys me. Be comedic in another way. You can talk about something else.
But anyway, she has a great plot line in this season. I go for it. Tell us what her plot line is.
So, as we know, she's not the Queen of Earth, despite Amos's...
She's the Queen of Earth.
Okay.
People don't always acknowledge that that's the truth, but she's the Queen of Earth.
So, we're just going to call her that. So, the Queen of Earth has decided that... Well, not decided, but there are some issues that are going on in the greater political whatevers of the system, right? And she is trying to basically get to the bottom of who's doing what. And she has tasked Bobby, which we find out, was that season 4? Where she had asked Bobby to come and work for her? Because she had lost the election. And she had asked Bobby to come and work for her. And Bobby had not taken her up on the offer then. But then she agrees later on. And Officer Ollie was understandably upset that she had waited so long to do it. But yeah, she
said her timing is shit or something.
Right. She doesn't turn her away because she loves Bobby. And so basically she is aware of the fact that things are going missing. That, you know, ships, weaponry, military personnel. Like all of this stuff is kind of like moving around. And she doesn't know who's doing what. She wants to figure out like where the black market kind of plays into any of this, if at all. And that's kind of what she's tasked Bobby to do. Am I forgetting something? I feel like I'm forgetting something.
Well, she's working with that Admiral dude because she knows that there's something wrong with there's that science ship that gets destroyed by Philip in the beginning of the season. And she knows there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And she keeps trying to warn people and they won't listen
and
to
no
her.
And no one is listening to her because she's anymore. Not, yeah, because yeah. She's not the lady. She's not actually Queen. Right. So then this is where, you know, when she meets with Amos, that's part of the reason that she kind of sequestered Amos when she found out he was coming back to Earth, because she thought that he might have had some kind of message or knowledge that, you know, from Holden, and she wanted to be privy to it, and he doesn't have anything. But still, it just shows that she's grasping for any bit of information that she can get while she's trying to put all this together. Then, of course, the attacks happen on Earth, and she... her husband is missing, presumed dead. We see that little bit of an exchange in this book. We also see that in the show when she adds his name to the floating memorial that they have as well. And then she basically gets kind of put back into the position of being de facto leader because, again, the woman that she had just lost the first minister spot to has died. And the new person is...
he was the education minister.
Yeah, he's kind of ineffective, and he's really leaning on her to like step forward and do things. She was the undersecretary for so long or whatever, and so basically she's like become the power behind the throne, as it were, for Earth. I feel like I'm still missing some stuff.
Well, I mean, he starts off like you like him, but then you find out they go to the war cabinet, and suddenly he's the warmonger, and Officer Rala is like, wait a minute, I've tried that, and it didn't work. I mean, that's literally how I lost the election last season.
That's right.
I had sent some Marines in to go try and capture Marco, and just ended up killing everybody, including the Marines. Marco had rigged it to blow. And so she resigns from this government, you know, the Admiral dude that she'd been working with. Like, she's been trying to get him to help her. He was refusing because you know, she's lost all political capital, and now he's... Yeah.
But I do want to talk about there's a particular scene because I actually got some credits here for this. When they're doing the election, and she... And that happened. She sent the Marines to go after Inaros, and they die, and she has to face this huge backlash from it. She gives the most incredible, like, apology speech I've ever heard, and it's so well done. And maybe she talks about her own personal experience, her son, and how he was in the military, and how he had died in military service, and how all she had wanted was to find out who she could hurt, who she could blame, who she could, and so she was recognizing that was her now for these people, and so she didn't try to justify the action, she didn't try to talk about grand military, you know, maneuverings or doctrine. She just is like, I'm very sorry, and she's so emotional and impactful in that scene. And it actually ends up winning her a lot of favor later on. But the reason why I obviously for a lot of things, I love that scene. But I had the ability to where I went and I talked about this particular scene and got a lovely response from Sheree herself on the little message board about it. So, yeah, David, if you'll remember, I was quite ecstatic that day.
Yes.
That, and then, you know, that started my love affair, my obsession with Sheree, which led to another exchange on Twitter later on. Highlights for me in my love of this show and these books. So, but you should go and watch it. That particular part, she gives that speech.
And what's great about that speech, or interesting about that speech, is that she goes home to her husband, and he's, like, complimenting her on it, and she basically admits that she had planned to give it the whole time, because the way she presents it in the speech is, like, it's off the cuff. Mm. She's in the moment doing it, and then she reveals later that she had planned it the whole time, and so that's actually, like, the breaking moment in at the end of last season with her husband. He's like, you go to Luna, I'm gonna stay on Earth, which is why she's so full of regret.
Right, because they've been having some difficulties, because as things have been ramping up with the campaign and with, you know, life in general, her and her husband had been kind of being distant from each other. And so, you know, it was a nice moment at first, because he was kind of like reaching out to her, because he was like, I didn't realize you felt this way about our son, and I'm seeing you differently, and I'm appreciative, and I'm whatever. And then she reveals that it was all a ploy, and he just, like, you can just see it, like the way he kind of just retracts from her, and she sees it, and she's like, crap, that's not the reaction I wanted. She doesn't apologize to him, but she's just like, oh, now I've hurt him by saying this. And then he's like, you go and do it. It's almost like he's saying, like, I understand this is what you now need to do, but I can't watch you be this person, so I'm going to leave to let you be fully you, and then we'll come back together later. And then unfortunately later never happens, because then the Luna attack happens and he is presumed dead. Now, we don't know that he's died. He's just missing in the aftermath of the attack, but I think it's probably safe to say he said, hey, what if they brought the show back and they were doing it like he is dead, and this leads her and Amos getting together?
I don't want them to get together. I just want them to be a bad cop. Or a good
bad cop, psycho cop. Bad cop, psycho cop. So, because she's no stranger to torturing people and stuff either. You know, we saw that in the very first season. True. She's torturing a belter. So,
first scene.
I don't know if I would like that. I don't want to see her threaten to torture you and then him actually doing it. You know, So,
that would be a bad combination. But and then of course all this ends with the temporary prime minister dude. He blows up one of the Belter stations in retaliation, and that causes him to lose favor with people. And so at the end of the season, Officer Rala is once again back in charge.
Yeah, because he resigns. He resigns, right? And then she's left.
Well, everyone else on the five people resigned when Officer Rala resigned, and then the rest of them resigned after that happened. So they've lost confidence in him. So he steps down, Officer Rala steps up, and then we have the big reunion scene. All of the characters show up on Luna, and Officer Rala is like, this is what Marco Anaros hates. He doesn't love, you know, people from different backgrounds working together. He's just someone full of hate. And then the final scene happens where the ships at the ring gate are hit by all the stealth tech asteroids, which is great because it just rips them apart. And they're like, when did this happen? It happened 40 minutes ago. But for us, it's all happening right now. We're seeing it on screen. And then the ships go through and they say, all right, Marco, we're leaving you the Earth system. We're going to take our own system. He's like, all right, stay on your side. I'll stay on my side, which is just a great, it was like the whole, I love when it's revealed that there have been plans going on the whole time, and it fits.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We never knew that this was happening on this level, but it makes sense. Great scene.
Well, as much as we could really continue to talk about even more of this, we are now at just over, just shy of an hour and 30 minutes. This is probably the longest show that we've done, and it's not even about Star Trek. So that does not mean we're going to have to like outdo ourselves with a Trek one at all, but just letting you know. With that, I will say, you know, thanks for tuning in and listening to us as we go on and on about this book series and the show that we clearly love. so very much. If you want to follow along, again, the next book that we are going to be reading is the sixth one, Babylon's Ashes. You can pick it up anywhere that you, you know, get your books from, Barnes & Noble. I think Half Price Books has them. You can order it on Amazon. It's there, you know. Other than that, we will be returning next week to our regular program, of course, which is Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We'll be talking about Season 5, Episode, is it 20? Ferengi Love Songs?
I think so. I think we're there.
Yes. Season 5, Episode 20. It's called Ferengi Love Songs. So back to more Ferengi stories for us.
We did that one.
We did?
We did Ferengi Love Songs. That was the last one.
Okay, so then it'll be Soldiers of the Empire, episode 21. I do apologize. I realize now why I'm off, because these episodes, we've already completed them, and I've scheduled them for release, but there seems to be some kind of processing delay with everything being released for everybody who listens to us on a podcast. If you're following along with us live, then you've already, you know, you're here. You know what the episodes are. You're current, right? But if you only listen to us on our podcast, then unfortunately, I think you're like 3 episodes behind. It's not your fault. It's ours. This algorithm thing has suddenly decided to not work. So I've been trying to get that cleared up. Hasn't totally happened yet. I know 2 episodes did drop like yesterday or the day before. So hopefully I can get the rest of them done this week. That way you'll only be the normal one off, because obviously we record live and then you get it afterwards. So hopefully that happens this week. Please bear with me, and we'll just continue on from there. Otherwise, as always, you can watch us on YouTube every week. You can also listen to us anywhere you happen to listen to podcasts. I do it on Spotify, of course. And until next week, guys, take care of yourselves.
Thanks, guys.